Yeah. Would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Michael DeBar, and I've been in the United States for many, many years now, 50 years. Came over here in 1972 in a rock and roll band called The Beatles, and we were huge. No, it's called Silverhead.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yeah. John Paul, George, Ringo,
you don't look bad
Michael.
At all for your age.
No, no. Well, I'm 23, and I've been through an awful lot in my life.
You and me both, because we're a similar age, so we're not going to admit to anything.
No, I've been here forever. I am an American, really, you know.
I don't know. You haven't lost the swagger or the accent.
Yes, well, that would be a big
mistake.
Or
the swaggering accent.
Swaggering is good.
As the case.
That's
swaggering,
the name of my new band, the Swaggering Accident.
Yeah, there you go. But we're sitting here today, and I'm going to kind of go to the end for a second, then we'll go backwards. And you made this record, and this record is beyond a labor of love. The passion that shows in this record is incredible. When did you wake up and say, you know, I've done all these things. I've been in all these bands. When did you wake up and just kind of look and maybe turn to your partner and just say, I've got to do another one. I've got to do this.
Yeah, thank you for all of that, what you've just said. But the album is very important to me. It could be my last in many ways because I wanted to go back to why I wanted to do it in the first place. You know, I mean, it was all about that era was astonishing. You know, I was 17 years old and I'd done To Sell With Love, so therefore I could get into every club. So I saw all these bands playing, you know, and it was something that I wanted to explore. I've always lived in the moment, you know, on a Krishnamurti level rather than, you know, going back and remembering all of this stuff. So it's very difficult for me to explain this perfectly. But what I would say is I went back to my roots is really what it was all about, you know, and it was such an amazing time because I'm singing the songs that I saw people write. You know, and sing for the first time themselves, especially Mark, you know, and Bowie. And I wanted to go back, see how that felt then, so I could live then and write these songs. Because somebody asked me the other day, did you take a long time in picking these 12 songs? And I said, no, I wrote them all 12 songs in 5 minutes. I didn't sort of aggressively say, I'm going to get it. I really felt, you know, this is perfect, the perfect thing. When you think of something that absolutely works, like the title of a song or something that's really exciting, I go, oh my God, that's a top 20 finish. You know, with this thing, I thought, I'm going to do these 12 songs that changed my life.
How many bands were you in before Silverhead?
None.
Now, this is interesting. Really?
Yeah, really.
Not a single band before?
No. I was in an actor. I was on stage. I was doing this musical, a nude musical called The Dirtiest Boy in Town. And it was really exciting to do that. And Andrew Lloyd Webber came to this show, which was, you know, everybody was coming to this thing because it was so cool and naked and sexy. And it's 1971 and everybody's all excited and doing a little bit of coke and then finding out that was a huge mistake. But I, you know, he came to the gig and he said, and I was singing, he said, would you like to sing some demos for a thing that I'm doing? It's called Jesus Christ Superstar. And I came in and I sang the demos with Ian Gillan. Ian Gillan, of course, of Deep Purple. So then Andrew says, you're a rock and roll star. And he goes to Gillan. Gillan goes to Deep Purple. Purple Records ran it and said, he's great. Let's do a band. Within 3 weeks, I had a band.
It's not supposed to happen that way.
I know. Well, my entire life was not meant to happen.
You're supposed to be like paying your dues and
there's no dues
on the piss stop and the whole.
Yeah, no dues, no dues at all. I just got into it. I don't know, you know, because To Sell With Love was such a big movie, and it was a sort of a rock and roll movie.
It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Such, so beautiful. Yeah. Sydney was so great to me. You know what he said to me? I'm wearing the shades. But he told me to, because I'm in a classroom. How am I going to be seen? How is the audience going to see out of this, you know, 30 kids? And he said, you know, Michael, I think you should really wear sunglasses.
But you're also making a statement by doing that, because you were the mod in the room.
Rock and roll, you know, got the bangs. Nobody else had bangs at that time,
right?
Which is the title of my autobiography.
There you go. Yeah, no, but you definitely... you definitely exuded a certain tone.
Yeah.
Of all the kids that were there.
Well, listen, androgyny hit the streets, you know, and I think there's a certain amount there because my hair was like that way in the shades, and it was a whole new thing to even dream about androgynous rock and roll, you know, which is why one called it glam. And I absolutely call it glam now. Why not? You know, is it a rude word? Is it a silly word? Would, you know, Dwayne Allman do like Mark Bolan? I could care less. But of course, like anything, like any genre of music, yes, it was abused.
Right.
Know? I mean, I wore mascara, of course I did, but I also wore it for 3 weeks. You know, it was like I was, you know.
Yeah, because following the trends never really tends to.
I've never believed in trends.
Gives you a long. Well, I don't believe in genres either. You know, glam is kind of like punk. It's a thing. But then people are like, well, is it rock and roll?
You know what it is? You know, looking in your beautiful home and the paintings that are on the wall, if those paintings are splashes of paint. So I'm not Shakespeare. I'm not sitting around working it out. It's not a poem. It's a song. It's a rock and roll song, which you could grunt or scream. You know, we're not trying to be lyrically Shakespearean.
The thing, people always ask me, you know, especially when I hear a new song, you know, why it works for me, right? And again, I go back to the old songs, but I always say it has to be a great song, and it does not have to be sung operatically. And let's face it, your voice is not an operatic voice, it's a rock and roll voice. Yeah. And a lot of the people that we're talking about didn't have operatic classic voices. They had voices that they could put over a song. And that when you heard it, you knew it was them.
Yeah, the thing is, it was all blues-oriented. Stevie Marriott, clearly, you know, Jagger. All of the great singers, Rod, they're all singing bluesy soul American artists. You know, it's not about anything other than that. It's about the blues. That's what it is. Rock and roll is the blues. And then it got sort of tied up with the glamorous thing. But for me, on a singing level, with this album, was I wanted guitar, bass, drums, and me, not even a tambourine.
That's right here, by the way. Yeah. I was going there. Yeah, yeah, you made very strong and definitive decisions on the sound of this record because you didn't even succumb to a synthesizer where even in the original there might, like Fox on the Run, definitely has some other fuzz and some other things in there.
Because guitar, bass, and drums is everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the great painters in the beginning of their careers, they were drawing perfect, you know, landscapes. And then suddenly Picasso had three eyes. You know, I mean, that's what I feel about it. I went back and to strip it down to nothing. And nothing became everything.
Well, and you didn't get fancy. You just said, it's only rock and roll, which is your way of saying you're not denying that it's well crafted. You're not denying that these players were absolutely positively as world class as it gets, that they could knock this out in their sleep if they wanted to. But they didn't knock it out in their sleep.
It was they loved those songs. You know, Eric Skirmhorn, the guitar player, you know, plays with a guy called Iggy Pop.
Oh, yeah, that guy. So, yeah, oh, yeah, that guy.
You know, and yeah, he's the strongest guitar player I've ever played with. And, you know, the rhythm section were Linda Perry's guys. So they were R&B with a very hard guitar. So, and that was exactly what I wanted, a hard guitar and a rhythmic, you know, rhythm vibe with the bass and the drums. And they were so good. And we did it in 20 minutes, the whole thing, you know. I mean, it was done so quickly.
So it was done live?
Oh, yeah.
It was?
In one room.
Right.
I wasn't fucking around here.
Right.
You know, I really wanted to do it properly, and I wanted to do it, close my eyes and sing, and not do it again. And if there was anything that was wrong, which there really wasn't, I was so disciplined about it because I loved the song so much and I didn't want to destroy it. You know, and the guys felt the same way. The first song that we played, and I looked at them and they're looking absolutely at each other. They're looking at each other while they're playing. That doesn't happen today.
Right.
You know, the bass player goes, well, I'll fix it. I'll go in and fix it after you've done this.
Yeah, let's retract that. Yeah.
You know, so I didn't put any sort of bandages over this thing. You know, I mean, this was what you hear is what we did.
One of the things you've said, we have to make sure that the next generations, that this doesn't get lost.
I am the Viagra of rock and roll, dude. You know, if it goes back or it goes up or it goes out, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, I hope youngins will grab it. The problem with that is, of course, you know, that their music, they want their music, and I understand that. But I like watching James Dean. Does that make sense to anyone?
Yeah.
You know, so, right. You know, therefore one would like listening to Free, you know, the band Free. And there was a lot of freedom in that studio, you know, because a lot of people wanted to come and watch us and all of that.
I'll bet.
And I just absolutely disavowed all of that. I didn't have anybody come and, you know, it was us and that was it, you know. And then we had a session where we invited a few people, a few very excellent musicians and very famous and talented. And they all applauded at the end of it. And it was one of the greatest moments ever. You can imagine that moment was really, really beautiful. And I thought, yeah, I've done it. I don't care how many records I sell. That's not the point.
This thing sounds really, really good. How did you choose that studio?
It's a studio that I've been working in for years. You know, when I signed with his label, Stevie Van Zandt, and then,
right,
and this guy, Paul Ill, who's the bass player on this album, has a studio. So it was also domesticated in a sense, you know, we just went in there without the sort of the terror of going into a gorgeous studio. It wasn't a gorgeous studio. It was about twice the size of this beautiful room here where you do your interviews. And the fact that we were so close together was in and of itself tremendously important.
And all it has to do is sound good. Really, you need good microphones and someone who knows how to work levels.
You bet. And we had Chris Wanza, who produced it with me and is just a brilliant guy of making it happen. You know, because there's very, very little double tracked and harmonies and all of that. I didn't want to do any of that. I did it here and there just on a chorus level, which you'll understand, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
And your listeners will understand. Just to give it more kind of room. But it just seemed to come like that. Just came to us and we delivered it. It was wonderful and remains wonderful.
Did the Velvets come first or come last? Because they were a little outside.
Yeah, that's here. Not. I took Lou because I figured that he was the guy. When you really think about it, who was the guy? Was it David? No, it wasn't. It wasn't David Bowie, and it wasn't even Mark, because Mark was on a whole other level. He's on a Tolkien-esque level. He wasn't, you know, he's not playing the blues. You know, he's playing Gandalf or Glamdalf in his case. But, you know, so therefore, you know, it's just an amazing feeling to do something that is simple and not complex. To complexify anything, you're going to be doing it for weeks and it's going to suck. Lou is way beyond all of that. And one of the things that I adored about him also was how rude he was to reporters, you know, which my favorite thing, you know, because he was just doing it because he was so bored with it. You know, that's the interesting thing about New Yorkers. They get bored really quickly.
Oh, yes, we do.
You know, so Lou Reed, I put on
It's an Achilles heel, but unfortunately, it's the way it is.
It's just the way it is. And I love him, you know, and I always will. And that's why I did the song, which is somewhat outside of the glam vibe. But I thought that he was extremely glamorous, especially when he wasn't in the Velvets. You know, when he was just on his own, he was all made up in the lipstick and the Bowie thing. But a brilliant, brilliant writer.
Let's talk about Gin Chapman.
Well, I love them. I mean, well, these not guys, such Nicky, but Mike Chapman is one of my dearest friends to this day.
But it's about quality. It's about authenticity. You know, and it has to be entertaining.
Well, that's the last word that you used is what Mike is only interested in, is entertainment. And
right.
But he's a great singer and he's a really good guitar player. So you know, he did my solo album, I'm Only Human. We're very friendly with him, my wife and I, with Mike. You know, when we went to London a few weeks ago, we spent a lot of time with him. And I just admire him so much. I really do. Whatever you say about him is absolutely true. He's one of the greatest producers and writers ever, especially at that time, you know, where songs were really, you know, well produced.
Well, yeah, and the question is, and this is again, is not the things are bad today.
No.
But there's still magic in the air.
Yeah.
and finding it these days.
Yeah, you gotta, you see, these days, and the finding is of a person, a human being, you know, whatever sex, you know,
yeah.
So many sexes, it's great. But it's not about that. It's about somebody with some charisma. I mean, Billie Eilish is an incredible person. And she's, you know, writing incredible songs with an incredible intellect, and or the simplicity of the repetition of rap. You know, that in itself is a machine, is an engine. Yeah. It's brilliant. You know, I would never, ever negate anything that's happening. But what I wanted to do was go back and do what happened.
What I do is I have you build a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside, and then songs by others in between.